Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching from God's Word you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to Him. If you're ever in the Madison, Alabama area, we'd love for you to worship with us on Sundays at 8:30 or 10:30 a.m. If you have any other questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, find us at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to also check out our Bible study podcast, Madison Church of Christ Bible Studies. Thanks again for stopping by.
You may remember the name Lance Armstrong from the late 90s to the mid 2000s. He was a guy that bust onto that cycling scene, actually made road cycling and road biking a lot more popular than it was. And what he was really well known for a while, was that he won the Tour de France for 7 straight years. From 1999 to 2005, something that nobody had done up until that point. But of course, there was a lot of other things that he ended up being famous for. One of those is that he did get cancer. And because of that cancer, what ended up happening was they came up with this idea of Live Strong. And you might remember those yellow bracelets that a lot of people wore that said Live Strong with a Nike swoosh on it. And the other thing that ended up happening with Lance, as we find out later in his career, is that he had been accused of taking performance-enhancing drugs. And so because of that, they stripped away all of those awards that he won. But there's one fact about his life that a lot of people don't know, that a lot of folks point to as actually the cycle of things that ended up causing other decisions in his life. And it was this, that he ended up divorcing his wife. And so when he was asked why he divorced his wife that he had been married to for several years, he said, well, it's not because I found someone else. He says, as I'm getting more and more into my cycling career, I guess what's happened is this. I just don't have time for my marriage anymore. Now, I don't know what became of Lance and his marriage, and I pray and hope that maybe a few weeks or months or years after that point at least, that something would have hit him and he realized what in the world he was walking away from. And when I think about Lance walking away from one of the most important things in his life, it kind of hit me that we're guilty at times if we're not careful of doing the same thing too. We choose a lot of really good things, but the danger of the things we oftentimes choose is we crowd out the most important thing. When I think about Lance and I think about us, I think about this book of Hebrews. It was a group of people that just maybe I hope that people were trying to encourage Lance in, were trying to encourage these Hebrew Christians to not walk away from the most important thing. But it's easy for them to maybe think that they should because they're enduring some very difficult persecution. They themselves are getting put in prison. They have family members getting put in prison and being dragged through the streets and being persecuted and killed. And because of that persecution that these Hebrew Christians are going through, a lot of them are thinking about going back to the traditional ways of Judaism, to go back to that law keeping. And so they thought, hey, life was easier then when we weren't attached to the name of Christ. So maybe that's what we should do. Is just go back to things before, and then we wouldn't have to deal with this persecution. So what the Hebrew writer is letting them know, please do not walk away from the most important relationship. And so Brandon did an awesome job last week of talking about and leading us in this beginning thought of how everything with Christ and being connected to Christ is going to be supreme over everything. And because Christ is supreme, we don't need to look back, understanding that He is always better. But today we're going to look at a beautiful and a challenging argument from the Hebrew writer to let us know something, and it's this, that Jesus Christ is actually better than the angels. Now what's interesting about the book of Hebrews up until this point, as you begin in chapter 1 and get into chapter 2, this is the first time we actually get what some might call a practical application. When we get to this part of Hebrews, it kind of makes me think of that time in the classroom. Maybe you remember in elementary school or in college when your teacher was talking and you saw his lips or her lips moving, but you weren't like really internalizing what they were saying. You just knew you were in the classroom and you knew they were talking. It was interesting. You notice other people were doing the same thing too. Then all of a sudden, everything in that classroom changed the moment the teacher said this. What I'm about to share with you, it's going to be on the test. And the moment that you heard those words, you noticed the entire room's demeanor changed. The people that were in La La Land are all of a sudden laser focused. You see choruses of pens and hear them going off, and people are now taking very meticulous notes. Why? Because they understand that something is at stake. It's this group of people that the Hebrew writer is writing to. They're going through something that at one time in our life, I think we all probably go through, is that if we're not careful, we too can be guilty of being dull towards the teachings of Christ. Oh, it's not because we don't believe them. It's not because we don't like them and we don't think that they're life-giving, they're life-sustaining. But if we're not careful, we can just sit there and hear the same things, do the same things, but not let our hearts be open to the life-changing power of what we're choosing. And so to this group of people that are wanting to call it quits, he's letting them know, listen, please don't grow dull on the teachings of Christ. Because what can happen if you do grow dull to those teachings is there is this very big danger of drifting away. Now, what's interesting about him is that as he's writing this, of all the things he picks as his very first argument to tell them that Christ is better, to don't go back, to hang in there with that persecution, to hang in there with that suffering, he picks angels. Now, at first that might seem odd, because to us today, maybe we don't hold angels in that high of esteem, but to Jewish tradition and Hebrew people, they held angels in a very high esteem. In fact, I read a lot of stuff from ancient Jewish folklore and Jewish tradition that they had talked about and thought about the angels a whole lot. In fact, one of the main reasons why they thought a lot of the angels is that they knew that the angels were actually ministering spirits. You actually go through the Old Testament, one of the things that you'll see as you go through the Old Testament is time and time again that the angels were coming along ministering to people. And the moment that they did, people were flocking to see what was going on. But one of the major reasons why he decides to pick angels and to let them know Jesus is better than them is one thing that we know about the Hebrew people, people in Judaism, is that they love the law. And one of their most memorable, most talked about moments was when Moses went up to Mount Sinai and received from God those Ten Commandments. Now, the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 33, but also in Acts and in Galatians, all allude to the fact that while God's hand did in fact write the law, it was the angels that actually delivered it. And so because of that, he's thinking, all right, I know they think a lot of angels, and I know that they think a lot of the law. In fact, they're thinking about going back to that law, going back to what they were before. So what I want you to know is you don't need to go back to what you were before, because you know those angels you think a lot of? Yeah, Jesus is better than them. But not just Jesus and the messenger is better, but the message is also better. Because they brought this law, and the law is great, but you're not under that law anymore. You're under something called grace. And so why in the world would you go back to being under the law when you can be set free from grace? So he's letting them know it's not just the message that was written, but the messenger that brought it is better. Don't go back. And so he's wanting them to stay the course. And so that's why you see in chapter 2, verse 1, it begin with this word, therefore. He's saying, therefore, since he is better than the angels. See, the therefore, if you were like me growing up in a religious setting, you heard time and time again, anytime you see a therefore, you need to figure out what it's there for, right? Well, this is one of those moments. What is the therefore, therefore? Well, you go back to chapter 1, and right before this, you have several psalms that list very specific reasons why Jesus is actually better than the angels. And so what we can maybe say is this, that therefore, because Jesus is better than the angels, we must pay closer attention to what we've heard, lest we drift from it. Now, I want you to notice a detail in this text. He doesn't say, therefore, you must pay closer attention to what you've heard because you're going to drift away. He uses the word what? We. I love this because he's not trying to act like, listen, this is just a problem that you guys are going to deal with. This is something that we could all deal with. And I love the fact that as a good leader, he does what a good leader does. He doesn't sit up on his ivory tower acting like, listen, I've got this figured out, and you lay people, well, you're going to have to figure it out for yourselves. No, he's saying, listen, we're all going through this. But is that not a reminder for every single one of us to never, ever let our guards down because we too could be guilty of drifting? That the Hebrew writer is saying we can do it. Every single one of us, the moment we let our guards down, we could be guilty of drifting too. And why is, by the way, Jesus so much better than the angels? Well, there's so many reasons we could discuss. One of those is the fact that he did something that no angel did, went and suffered for us. He was a redeemer, something no angel did. He's better than the angels because the angels worship him, not the other way around. He's better than the angels because the Father calls him something that he calls no angel, and that's Yahweh, that's Jehovah, that's God. But he's also better than the angels in the fact that he is now seated on the right hand of the throne of God because he's completed his work while the angels are continuing to minister and to do their work. Do you see the difference? The angels stand before the God, but the Son sits down. The angels, they are ministering spirits, but not governing spirits. Service, not dominion, is their calling. So what we would say is that Jesus is seated on the throne. And while we talk about him being seated, please understand that doesn't mean he's not serving. Oh, he does. But he serves from a place of governance. And that's good news for every single one of us. It's good news that he serves from a place of leadership because, as we're going to dig into today, that when he serves and he ministers to us, he actually has the power to redeem and purchase what you and I cannot redeem or purchase. So he's saying, therefore, since he is so much better than angels, here's what you need to do. Pay closer attention. Notice he's basically saying, oh, you've paid attention, but part of the issue is you haven't paid a closer amount of attention. And some of your translations actually use this word to take heed. Now, the word heed in those translations in the Greek, and I'm probably going to say this wrong, but it's prosako, which means to hold on to be addicted to guard, or to grasp with all diligence. And when I saw this in the Greek lexicon, there's one part that really stood out to me that's probably standing out to you too. And he's saying, therefore, since he is better than the angels, you need to be addicted to. That really stood out to me because when I think of addiction personally, at times I might think of things that are negative. We might think of someone that struggled with and been addicted to drugs or whatever addiction it might be. But the idea here of when he says to take heed or to be addicted to, it's kind of like the idea of someone who is addicted. If someone's addicted to something, the moment that they go through a time of difficulty, they find themselves going to that. Or maybe when there's nothing going on, when they're maybe not doing a job or they're busy with something, they find themselves at times resorting back to whatever that addiction is. He's saying, that's what I want for you in your relationship with God. The moment things are going really good, I'm wanting you to understand where those blessings come from. But when there's moments of like silence where you're not actually doing a job and you don't have your hands involved in something, I want you to go to him. And when moments of difficulty come, because they will, don't resort to this, but resort to him. That's what he's getting to take heed, to pay closer attention. And he says, if you don't, here's what's going to happen. You can drift away. I absolutely love the meanings of this word drift. It really means two different things. One of those, it alludes to the idea of like a boat that has an anchor that's not strong enough to hold that boat in place. Or you throw out something, but what you're throwing out is not able to keep the weight of what is pushing against it. Kind of reminds me, if you've ever been to the beach before and you're out treading water, and this especially happens if you're talking with another person out in the Gulf. And you're standing there talking, and you've been standing in that sand, maybe even waist deep, like 10 minutes. And before you know it, you look up, and you're like 300 yards down from where you originally were. You had no clue that this was even happening. You're like, whoa, how did I get from here all the way to there? And so when we would go to the beach, we would have this blue umbrella. And whenever we were out in the water, I would be enjoying time with my family. But I would also every so often keep my eyes, right, focused on that blue umbrella. Where's the blue umbrella? Where's that blue umbrella? Because I know what can happen is I can be in another place on the other side of the beach before I know it, keep my eyes on that blue umbrella. That's what he's getting at here when he talks about drifting away. That if our eyes are not constantly on the most important thing, drifting can happen to every single person. But what's neat too, the other meaning of drift actually alludes to the idea of somebody choking on food. And the reason why, to me, this is very personal and I think communicates something to us today is that when he says drift in their minds and they thought of choking on food, the idea was the fact that you're actually doing something that can give you life, which is food, something that gives you nourishment, which is food, something that is good, that is food. But if you take that food for granted, and like with kids especially, have you noticed like they don't believe in chewing sometimes? It's like trying to see how much they can get in their cheeks before they actually swallow. And so when that happens, even though you're eating something that can provide you life, if you take it for granted and you don't do it right, what can happen? Well, it can kill you. That's what he's getting at, that right now, just like in that water, you might be surrounded by something really good, but if you take for granted the one that's out in front of you that your eyes should be on, you're going to be in a place that you never, ever thought you would be. And when I thought about this, I thought about the well-known evolutionist and atheist Charles Darwin. A lot of you may know this. He was actually a very religious person. But this is what he said. He said, "I came to gradually disbelieve in Christianity as a divine revelation. Disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but at last it was complete. The rate was in fact so slow that I felt no distress, and I have never since doubted even for a single second that my conclusion was correct." When I think about these few verses here, I think about the arms that come down in front of that railroad. But of course, maybe y'all have seen the one in Limestone County that doesn't have the arms that will come down and block you from going across that railroad track. It actually has a sign on it that just says to stop, to look, and to listen. Because a lot of times we don't have something that come right in front of us that says, "Hey, stop." Because notice in that text, it says to take heed. It doesn't say heed, it says to take it, which means what? There's a responsibility on our part to actually do something. It's kind of like when Jesus is telling the people in the middle of the boat when the storm is happening, he's like, "Listen, guys, you know, hang in there," right? No, he tells them, just like Paul says later on, right? You need to take that courage. It's something you grasp. It's something that you go after. And so he's telling them, you need to listen. And there's a big difference, of course, in hearing something and listening to something. There's two levels of listening. They call low level. The other is high level. Low level is when you just sense something. You just notice it. But the high level is when you contemplate and you comprehend the very things that you're hearing. That's what he's getting at, that high level of listening. Here's an example of that. A few weeks ago, we were in a mall, and just like every mall usually does, we heard music playing, but you didn't really know, we weren't paying attention to what was being played or what was being said. You just knew there was music. I noticed it. I sensed that there was music in the mall. Well, then all of a sudden, over that loudspeaker, we hear "Amazing Grace." And I was like, "What in the world? This isn't Chick-fil-A. Like, why in the world is Amazing Grace playing at a mall?" And then my mind, because I hear Amazing Grace, it didn't just notice it. It starts going down this trail. And I start to think, I wonder if the owner of this mall is Christian or something, or maybe the DJ upstairs accidentally slipped this in the tracks, or... And then I started to think, I wonder if other people notice that the song Amazing Grace is being played right now. And so I start looking around and I notice that every few people, there's somebody mouthing the lyrics to what they hear. And then I start to think, you know, wow, this is kind of crazy. We're in a public place right now and there's tons of people mouthing Amazing Grace. And then it hit me. I was like, man, here we are in a mall and I'm thinking about myself and what we can get us, but yet I have yet to bring God in this moment, have a spiritual conversation with people. You see what the trail it took me down? Once I actually didn't just notice the grace, but comprehended the grace. That's what he's talking about, that when you listen, let it take you down these trails of loving people and thinking about people and seeing people different. Because to a group of people that are persecuted, that are struggling, one of the things that we all know is if we see other people as people that God created, people that God loves and broken just like us, it then puts in perspective a little bit better. Doesn't dismiss it, but puts in perspective that persecution that maybe we're going through. So he says to listen, but notice what he also tells them to do. He says, well, let's look. And if you look in verse 4, the looking he's talking about is the miracles, the wonders that Jesus has done. And so I thought about in this part of the lesson, just listing for you a bunch of the miracles that are in the Bible, and that would be good. But I also know that if you're here today and you're struggling in your faith, and as you struggle with that faith, what you might need is, well, I need outside evidence, outside of the Bible, to know that those miracles are true. Well, is that even out there? Well, actually, I'm going to list four different people throughout history that were not writers from the Bible. And two of these people were actually used throughout history to help write your history books that are in your public and your private schools. So what's interesting is they talked about these miracles of Jesus, but they also talked about moments in history, and we use those. So let me just put in perspective a few of those people. Josephus, he says, now there was this man at this time, Jesus, a wise man, even if it's lawful to call him that. He was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as those that received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and the Gentiles. Those who loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive the third day. The divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. Look what Irenaeus said. He said, whatever soever things he heard from them respecting the Lord, both with regard to his miracles and his teaching, and Polycarp backs this up, having thus received from the eyewitnesses of the word of life, would recount them in harmony with the scriptures. And then Quadratus said this in the early second century, our Savior's works, moreover, were always present, for they were real, consisting of those who had been healed of their diseases, those who had been raised from the dead, who were not only there while they were being healed and raised up, but were afterwards constantly present. And this one I thought was fascinating. This is Celsus, who actually did not believe and follow Jesus and was an opponent to Christianity, but he still pointed out the fact that Jesus did something amazing. He said this, that he agreed that Jesus performed miracles, but he just said they were done by sorcery and magic. I mean, I could go on and on and on for things for us to look at. Listen, look. But we also have to make a decision at times to stop. You know, just like the arms that come down in front of those train tracks, a lot of times we don't have that to tell us to stop. We have to make that decision on our own. And so in getting ready for this message, I actually looked up several lists of different things that people point to as to why folks over the years have drifted away from their faith. So I looked at each list and decided to pick the top three of reasons why people have fallen away from their relationship with God. Reason number one was that they find it easy to separate from fellowship. This, to me, was the one that I see the most in ministry, that little by little people become disconnected, more disengaged, and more disengaged from their relationship with God and fellowship. The second one that I also thought was interesting, it says you're tormented by doubts, but you just suppress them. You remember two weeks ago, when we talked about Asaph and the doubts that he had? And when we talked about those doubts, we mentioned how there's honest doubts and there's dishonest doubts. Honest doubts say, you know, I need to learn more and I don't have it figured out. Dishonest doubt says, I know everything I need to know and no one can tell me anything. One of those takes a step forward, the other one takes a step backward. It's not a sin to have doubt, but I will tell you this, it's absolutely dangerous and detrimental for you to suppress them. If you have doubt, reach out to somebody. If you have doubt, please also understand that God the Father can handle those doubts. But the third thing that was interesting that was on several lists that I wouldn't have put on there first, but now after I see it, I get it, is one of the indications you might be drifting is if you have a bitter spirit. These are the people that, as we've talked about before, that if you look for the wrong in a situation, you will always find it. I mean, you can be in the middle of something good, but find the one thing that you just don't like and find yourself drifting in that direction. Or maybe at times what happens is we can be guilty of wearing our feelings on our shoulders too much to the point that we look for ourselves to get offended, and just like the negativity, we will find that too. And if we're careful, we can let that bitterness set in, and little by little, it does cause us at times to drift away. I think why he's writing this is to help us understand that it's so easy to lose progress that you've made in your walk with God. and you have to be very careful to guard it. So that's why I want to give you the action step now. What are the angels that are in your life right now? I'm talking about the good things. But these good things that are causing you to not see Jesus the way you need to. Not make him that anchor. So then what is something you can do to see him better? So after these warnings, he now gets into a really interesting part. This to me is the exhortation that Brandon was talking about, the encouragement. Because while I know I don't need to drift away, but what makes it so important for me not to, he includes heaven and he includes, as Brandon talked about, that eschatological language of end times to motivate you to know to not go back. He says this, "For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come of which we're speaking." It has been testified somewhere, which I love the fact that it says that in the text because it makes me feel good when I forget stuff. He's like, well, you know, one of the ones that wrote the Bible said it somewhere. You know, what is man that you are mindful of him? Or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection under him, he left nothing outside of his control, and at present, we do not see yet everything in subjection to him. If you're like me when I first read that, I'm like, wait, what? You know, that was a very deep thing to try to internalize and to understand. And for me, growing up, and for years, even through college, I used to always think that when he says and uses the word him here, he's actually just only referring to Jesus. Now, eventually, he is going to refer to Jesus, but the word him that he's actually using, you can see it underlined as man and him in these instances here in Hebrews 2, is this word that means human beings or humanity. He's actually saying, like, who is humanity that God would actually give us some responsibility? Because in verse 8, in just a second that we're going to read, he's actually connecting, you'll probably notice it cross-referenced in your Bible, Psalm 8 and Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, remember when God created the world and he created later on Adam and Eve, and he told them that they were going to watch over everything and care for everything? And then Psalm 8 actually echoes that exact same truth. He's saying, listen, that things right now, it's hard for you to fathom this, but God has given you blessing. He's given you responsibility. And so he's thinking and saying, basically, what is it that you would be so mindful of humanity like that? What are we as people that you would actually care for us? And this is hard for us to fathom now. It was hard for them to fathom then. And one of the reasons why we know it is, he says this, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. At present, we don't see yet everything in subjection to him. He's basically saying the reason why it's so hard for you to see it this way is because you look around and you see famine. You look around and you see people on the other side of the world that don't have clean drinking water or enough to eat. You see here in America the orphan crisis. You see broken people. You hear broken things happen all the time. And if we're not careful, it can make us think that God's lost all control. He has not. It doesn't feel right now that God has given us responsibility and there's something special about his people. And so here's why he tells us you don't have to struggle with this. He says, but we see him for a little while, was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. You see what he's saying? If we endure with Jesus Christ, one day we're going to experience exactly what Jesus was experiencing. We'll have that victory, that deliverance, and that dominion. What I appreciate so much, too, about the honesty of the Hebrew writer, he doesn't try just to make them feel good by saying, listen, because you follow Jesus now and you have a better perspective, you stopped, you looked, you listened, all of the persecution, all the difficulty, all the suffering, it's just going to go away. He doesn't say that. You see what he's saying? That the difficulty that you're going through, the faith that you have in the middle of that difficulty, it doesn't prevent fatigue. But what it does do is this. It gives you a place to sit. You have a place at the king's table. And I appreciate so much that honesty. And so he concludes then in the last few verses by letting us know four pictures of Jesus that when you're wanting to walk away, when you're wanting to call it quits, when you're wanting to just leave what you're going through to go back to the old paths, first, one of the reasons why you don't have to is that you have a king in your life right now that actually got involved in your life. Look what he says in verse 10. He says, "For it was fitting that he, for whom and by all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering." In 1964, Kitty Genovese was in downtown Manhattan at night, and she ended up getting stabbed. She screamed to the top of her lungs, and all the lights in downtown Manhattan came on, and people began to look out their windows. The man that stabbed her was getting ready to run because he just assumed that all the people that saw what was happening were going to come down and help her. In fact, if you want to be precise, there were 37 people that were eyewitnesses to seeing it all. He stood there for a second, noticed that no one came to her rescue. He stole from her and finished the job. That's not Jesus. He was a king that actually came down and he got involved in your life. And he didn't just, please understand, risk his life for you. He cost his life, everything. He is a king who gets involved. Don't go back. Hang in there. The second thing is this. We have a champion who saves. If you look in verse 10, it says that he was the founder of our salvation. That word founder means two things. It can also mean redeemer or champion. The word redeemer means to purchase, one who buys something. It's what Job was experiencing when Job was going through a difficult time, when he was losing everything, and his friends told him to curse God and die, to walk away from that. But he says this, "I know certainty that my redeemer, one who purchases, lives." It makes a huge difference when you're going through something difficult to know that someone's purchasing something that you yourself can't purchase, who's handling something that you can't handle. But the idea here of a champion was giving them imagery of what they knew battles to be. See, during this day, whenever there was battles, they wouldn't just all the time have all the armies attack each other, but sometimes they would send out one representative from each side. It's kind of like with David and Goliath. God's people sent out David, and then the Philistines sent out Goliath, and whoever won that battle was then the champion. He's depicting Jesus as the one that goes out and fights a battle that you and I can't fight on our own. He's saying that's why you don't need to go back to the ways of Judaism. That's why you don't need to go back to the old law. You have someone that's actually going out and fighting battles that you can't fight. Why would you go back? When you have a champion who actually does that for you, but also he says you have a brother who's not ashamed of us. I love in verse 13 how it says twice and again. He's really wanting us to listen, right? To take heed. He says, "And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me." Do you notice the familial language here? Oh, he says children. And Hebrews continues this familial language all throughout. It was actually mentioned this morning when in the communion thoughts of how he calls us brothers. Now, I'm going to try to say this in a very sensitive way. But I think we all have maybe one family member that when you go to like Christmas or a reunion, and you get back in the car and your mom and dad will say something like, "You know, when Uncle so-and-so said this, you know, Andrew, we don't always do what Uncle so-and-so says." Or maybe that was just me. I know I had that happen. And you love that person, but you didn't always endorse what that person was or stood for. I don't know if y'all had that aunt or uncle. If you didn't, you might be that aunt or uncle. I don't know. But, you know, we all probably had that person. And at times, from an earthly standpoint, it's very easy for us to have that. And here's the thing, what I absolutely love. He calls us children when none of us deserve that type of language. Think back to John chapter 20. Right after Jesus rose from the dead, the first thing he says to Mary is, "Can you go get my brothers?" He calls the guys that betrayed him, that denied him, when he needed him the most, needed them the most, brothers. If it's the New Andrew version of the Bible, I'm saying you lazy, cowardly men, why were you not there when you should have been? But he calls them brothers. And then on top of that, you look at the genealogy of Jesus. There's adulterers, there's murderers, there's outcasts. And he calls them the family tree. So what I'm saying is, if he's not ashamed of them, he's not ashamed to own you. We have a brother who is not ashamed of us, and that should make a difference. And the final thing, as we see in verses 17 through 18, is we serve a high priest who can actually do something about it. Look what he says in verse 17 and 18. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become merciful and faithful as a high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation in place of our sins. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. How does him suffering help us? And how does that help us and mean more when we pray? Well, what's interesting is I read an article about this very verse from a psychiatrist and psychologist perspective. And one of the things that they talked about is the value in knowing that somebody's been through something as you come before them. It makes a huge difference to know that when we come before Jesus, you're like, well, I've been tempted by this. Since he was tempted in every way we are, but he remained without sin. Well, I've been betrayed by this friend and I'm thinking about walking away. Oh, he was betrayed, but yet called him brothers. He's saying he can help you because he's been through it, but also he can help you because he did something about it. 1 John 1:9 says, if we confess our sins, he is able to forgive them. He's able to not just say something. I mean, here's the thing. Tons of people throughout history died. But his spirit came back into his body and made him alive again. He's saying, listen, I give the opportunity for everybody to have that same casket exploding power, that you don't have to have the fear of death anymore. It's amazing you think about the two greatest fears that people have, the fear of public speaking, which I get, and then the fear of death is the second one. Because I think our minds are very guilty at times of drifting to this place that death is the end. But by Jesus, as it says here, tasting death for everyone, he's saying, listen, you don't have to be fearful of death. I've taken the fear, the uncertainty of it, because you know that there's something more. Yeah, you're going to go through persecution, but in the meantime, you have a champion who saves you, who's fighting battles you can't. You have a priest who's helping, and you have somebody that even when you don't feel like you have familial status, he calls you brother and he calls you children. Does that not sound awesome? So if you're here today and you're going through something difficult, please, please don't try to carry that on your own. You weren't meant to. Bring it before God the Father that calls you a children, but also bring it before your church family who loves you. That maybe what you need to do is to go to one of these exits and meet one of our shepherds and pray with them. Or maybe for some of you, you want to walk forward and confess sin or the fact that you need help. We all do. We all have some type of vice. We all have something that our hearts find ourselves going back to. Don't grow dull to the teachings of Christ. But maybe for some of you, you've never made the decision to put on Christ in baptism. You know, I think about that casket exploding power that is described in Romans chapter 6 as it connects our baptism to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Just as Jesus went into that tomb and came out brand new, that's exactly what happens to each and every one of us. And then 1 Peter 3 even alludes to the fact of Noah and the flood, that when the waters covered that earth, that Noah and his family, they actually made it safe. Well, the same thing can happen to you through that baptism. And he connects there again, the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's what the Hebrew writer is getting at. You are a resurrected, brand new people. Why in the world would you go back to what you were before? Don't live under that law. Live under the beauty of God's grace. So whatever you have a need of today, please, please, please come now while we stand and we sing this song together.